program regularly seen at this time will not be seen so that we may bring you the following special report. NBC News presents Apollo, A Journey to the Moon. Here speaking from NBC News Space Center is Chet Huntley.
Good afternoon. The nation's capital continues to say, welcome, well done, nice going to the Apollo 8 astronauts. And in turn, the crew of Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders have given their heartfelt thanks in ceremonies at the White House this morning and later before a joint meeting of the Congress. But now comes what may be the most exciting part of this day's story. The astronauts are about to hold a news conference in the auditorium of the State Department building. And we shall hear from them the first extensive public details of their 6 days of history. So in a few moments, in their now familiar, affable, eloquent, but simple way, we shall get that story. First, this brief message.
Wait a minute, Dan. No more water in that can. They're the best peas in this land. And nothing cooks them better than butter.
Butter.
With peas this good, we really should cook with butter.
Butter.
Not just water, butter. Rich.
Butter.
Pure.
Butter.
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 Cooked in butter vegetables from Libby's.
Libby's made peaches and pears and fruit cocktail taste close to the same as when picked from the tree.
How did they do it?
The sugar was taken from out of the syrup, but all they expected was low calorie. Lo and behold, serendipity.
Libby's low calorie fruits taste more like fruit taken right from the tree.
Something good is always cooking at Libby's.
And now for the story of the flight of Apollo 8 from the crew members themselves. Let's go to the auditorium of the State Department building in Washington. Roy Neal is standing by there. Roy?
There is an air of expectancy here at the auditorium of the State Department. As some 200 or 300 news people stand by, the astronauts are due almost momentarily. And even before the conference begins, some news has been made. There they are now coming into the room, receiving a round of applause. Even before the conference begins, we've learned that Frank Borman has a new job, a non-flying position. He will be Deputy Director of Flight Crew Operations. Now, Julian Shear of NASA.
Thank you for coming. Before we begin, I would like to announce on behalf of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration that Frank Borman, effective today, has been named Deputy Director of Flight Crew Operations at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. As most of you know, Donald K. Slayton is the director of that operation. So Frank becomes an official part of... becomes an official part of NASA management. He'll be on the other side of the fence, thankfully, for a while. I'll introduce now the three astronauts. We'd like to follow the format of going through their remarks and the slides, and then we'll be open for question and answers. I'm sure you recognize to my left Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders, and we're ready to begin.
Thank you, Julian. We thought perhaps it might be most appropriate to follow the same format we followed when we debriefed our management in Houston, in which each one of us covers selected portions of the flight. And then, of course, we'll do it so that we don't let it drag on too long, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have. It fell my lot to discuss first the launch and the pre-launch mission phase of the mission, and then Jim Lovell will tell you about navigating to and from the moon, and Bill Anders will take you on a guided tour of the moon, complete with slides. The launch on the Saturn V was an incomparable experience. The vehicle, as you know, weighs over 6 million pounds, and I found out by reading one of the press releases that it burns fuel at the rate of 15 tons a second, which impressed me mightily, but The actual launch itself was very similar to the Titan launch, as far as the Titan Gemini launch, as far as we were concerned, with the exception that as we cleared the tower, the noise within the spacecraft became so loud that effective intercrew communication was, for all practical purposes, lost. The G's built up rapidly. We had a rapid and sudden staging event, which seemed to me to be more abrupt than the Gemini staging. And then came the old man's boosters, the Saturn II and the Saturn 4B, the S4B. It's a very comfortable ride. We sat and Jim was able to plot out the trajectory in real time and assure me continually that we were on track and on station. So we injected into orbit with a nominal, almost a perfect booster. The only thing that we noticed of any concern at all was a slight oscillation about 30 seconds into toward the end, 30 seconds from the end of the S2 stage burn. Now, I've been assured by Dr. von Braun that that was not a pogo. We didn't get any feedback or any coupling with the structure. It was merely a oscillation in the oxidizer pump of one of the S2 engines. So it was really no problem. I think it's important to note that this is the same Saturn V that on its last flight suffered severe oscillations in the first stage, and we've fixed it perfectly. And if any of you are familiar with the complications of decoupling a structure in an engine, you know that that was a mighty task. In orbit, the S4B was a particularly smooth vehicle. We went almost two complete orbits, and with it under control, although we could see the flashes of the rockets controlling it, we could not feel them, nor could we hear them. And it was a rather eerie feeling, just continually tracking the Earth without really knowing why we're, or what was keeping us there, or how we were keeping our position. The separation and turnaround were, again, just about what we had expected, with the exception that the force, or the thrust, associated with the separation of the spacecraft from the booster was considerably more than we'd been led to expect. I think this was perhaps had something to do with the fact that we had a new system of getting the panels off the S4B. We turned around, stayed with the S4B, and simulated a docking maneuver, convinced ourselves that it could be easily done, and then we thrust away from the S4B to leave it. Unfortunately, it was more friendly than we had anticipated, and it took some time and another maneuver before we could successfully really say that we were on our way. And once we had left the S4B, I went to sleep and Jim took over to get us there.
After finally figuring out that I was really in orbit on the way to the moon, I decided to do some navigation. But before that, in Earth parking orbit, I did manage to get out of my seat while Frank and Bill stayed securely strapped in, because we were going to burn the S4B a second time, and do our first optics check and an alignment of the platform, which of course is very important before we commit ourselves to the translunar voyage. I did notice when I was getting out of the seat that my past experience included many hours in Gemini, but I was strapped in the seat in Gemini, and Apollo offers quite a larger volume than the Gemini spacecraft, and I found myself floating all over the place at first. After we committed ourselves to the translunar voyage, of course, one of our jobs is navigation. In Gemini, it's easy to predict yourself. The ground tracks you quite closely. Our main worries are coming back in to a particular spot. But when we go to the moon, we have to be pretty careful of two things. One is that we don't want to run into the moon, and two, we want to come back at a particular angle to re-enter. And of course, if we lose communications, our onboard navigation is primed. My particular job was to check the onboard navigation. One little surprise I got when I first started was the fact that the S4B booster, at the time when I started my work, was venting fuel. And it put up millions and millions of what John Glenn had described way earlier as fireflies. This, of course, was fuel droplets or fuel ice crystals. And when I looked into the optics to start getting the stars for sightings, I saw nothing but millions and millions of stars. It was almost like a snowstorm out there. So this complicated navigation for a little bit in the beginning. I did have a chance during our particular translunar voyage to take a look at the Earth, and I might say there is a sensation to the stomach that is hard to describe when you see the Earth slowly recede from you. We made two burns, translunar. The first one was with the SPS engine, and we did that particularly to check out the engine so that we knew that we had a good engine when we arrived at the moon. Our second maneuver, and only two totally en route, was a burn of, I believe, 4 feet per second, and this was to get our closest approach to the moon at about 60 nautical miles. I might add that the S4B, the big booster, the third stage, put us on such a precise trajectory that we actually had to burn out of it a little bit so we could use the SPS engine. Of course, the big milestone for the three of us as we approached the moon, and I might add that we never really saw the moon. It was a crescent moon, and most of it was dark. I saw it several times in the optics as I was doing some sightings. But by and large, the body that we were rendezvousing with that was coming from one direction as we were going to another, we never saw. And we took it on faith that the moon would be there. Which says quite a bit for ground control. And we prepared ourselves for our lunar orbit injection, our insertion, and we made the burn of some 4 minutes. I might add that I have all the confidence in the world of the engine we had. It was a beautiful maneuver, and suddenly we found ourselves in lunar orbit.
Bill? I'd like to say that my main job on the flight was to keep the spacecraft systems running and to be prepared to take care of any possible malfunction that might arise. But my job was pretty easy. The contractor and subcontractors had done a wonderful job in building the vehicle. The CAPE had done an excellent job in checking it out. So except for a few very minor problems, I was almost a passenger. We did get to lunar orbit, though. I became one of the photographers. And I think the best way to tell you about this is just run through some selected slides, just to show you some of the things we saw and give you some of our impressions. Could we have the first slide, please? The first slide is one you've probably seen, but one of the Earth and one we think was most dramatic. We see here Florida, the Grand Banks of the Bahamas, Cuba, the large weather cell. Next slide, please. This is a shot taken further out as we move away from the Earth. Africa here, South America in this area. Intertropical convergence zone right in this area here. Next slide, please. Again, moving out further, we have South America, Isthmus Tehuantepec. Again, the Grand Banks of the Bahamas, just barely visible. And this very blue spot was visible almost all the way to the moon. We're at about 70,000 miles at this stage of the game. Next slide, please. Can't tell much of what you have here, except we did want to show you the scale as it looked as you moved out. You might note the bright spot here is a reflection off the water from the sun. Next, please. And again, that's just about the way it looked prior to the time we went around behind the moon. You can see Antarctic continent down here on the bottom. Next, please. Well, we were in lunar orbit after our burn. And this, I think, is a very good view of the nature, the texture of the surface on the backside of the moon or in the Terra. It's very heavily cratered. We referred to it as sand, really dirty beach sand or dark gray. Very little color, if any at all, maybe just a faint whiff of brown. Next slide, please. Here was a welcome view, our first view of the Earth over the lunar horizon. This is taken from a telephoto lens, and therefore it looks a little bit bigger. I think you can see a corner of Africa showing up. Next slide, please. This is the crater Longinus, the one we mentioned on our first revolution. The browns you see here are really not indicative of the color of the lunar surface. As I mentioned, it's mainly grays and blacks. This crater is approximately 130 miles in diameter. 130 miles in the characteristic central peak in these large impact craters. You can see the slumping of the sides. It occurs with age after the impact. Next. Here is a remarkable view that we had on our second lunar sunrise. This is the crater that we had the code name for of Von Braun. The lunar horizon here to the southeast. The thing that I think interests us all here was this sand dune or grass raked appearance of the surface, which was evident in all directions and quite a bit greater than this picture brings out. Next, please. Here's one of the slides that to me was one of the most valuable and most interesting taken on the flight. As you know, there has always been the controversy among those who studied the moon as to the nature of the holes, whether they are volcanic in origin or meteoric impact. Certainly there are both, and I think this one, at least at an initial glance, indicates to me very strongly that there are volcanics on the back of the moon. We see here what appears to me to be a flow coming over the surface, actually more noticeable by visual observation. What appear to be fine collapsed lava tubes in this area. Another interesting point is the masking of the features in this area, which might be cinders from a cinder cone up here. This flowing appears to come down into this area in what might appear to be volcanic domes. You have an unusual concentration of craters here. I think this slide and others like it will give us much to study for the next several years. This is a smaller crater in the large crater that we had a call sign for of America. Next slide, please. Jim, you want to comment on this one, please?
This is a smaller crater, again in a call sign crater called Gemini, which we were using as control points. Now, on the backside of the moon, we had photography taken from orbiter, but we were not too sure of the coordinate system. The people felt that the actual location of the craters could be as much as 10 degrees or 160 miles off. And one of the jobs of navigation was to determine just what the coordinate system was, just where the craters were located with relationship to one another. And so we picked this crater, and we picked as a control point a small crater inside another small crater, which I could pick up with the optics very well, and Bill has the pointer on it right now. And we marked with our guidance and navigation system this particular crater. There are some very unusual features to this crater, which we really didn't discover until we looked at the photograph more closely. You can see the slumping of the crater side at the top and how it seems to come down and form little rills or swirls down at the bottom of the crater, which is a quite unusual feature. And at the top, you might see a new crater that we had discovered many of on the back side. Bill?
Next slide, please. This is the large crater named by the Russians as Tsiolkovsky. It was taken at a relatively high sun angle, which brings out color contrast quite well, but does obscure topographical detail. Our track was along in this direction. This crater was to our south. It was off this slope here and out on these surface where we had the only confirmed sightings of boulders from orbit. They were large boulders out on this mare filling material. This crater is roughly 80 miles in diameter. It's a very noticeable and dark feature on the backside of the moon. Next slide, please. Here's a side taken almost at the subsolar point, that point where it's high noon on the moon. And this high sun angle, and by looking straight down, you get the very dramatic difference in albedo that's brought out here with the very bright new impact craters. Actually, there are no more new craters in this area than in any other that we saw, except here, they're just more noticeable. This was a feature we didn't observe in our flight. Right under this this mark is the actual reflection of the sun, or the pilot's halo, as we aviators call it, and possibly that's why aviators often think they're better than most people. Next slide, please. Here's another view showing the general nature of backside or terra photography. Particularly interesting because of these anomalous dark regions, which again indicate new volcanic activity, possibly a lava flow some kind. Another less obvious feature up in this area. Next slide, please. Here is one of the very bright and dramatic fresh impact craters. These were the only features on the Terra that had any general, any sharpness to their relief. The edges were quite sharp, often with this dark ring right on their inner walls, on the upper inner walls. And of course, the very bright ejecta material thrown out in all directions. There were several of these, and they were most remarkable. This crater is roughly 2 kilometers in diameter. Next slide, please. Here is a series of features to the south of our track as we approach the near side. Actually, these are visible from Earth. I won't go into their Earth names, but they have some very remarkable features, which will give us a lot to study for a long time. These cracks or rills, which appear in the bases of these craters. Here's a rill that though it appears to be part of the filling of this crater, actually goes right through the wall, which is a very interesting point. Here's something in these craters that's filled it off from this area, which strongly suggests volcanic activity. Here is the hint of this whirlpool feature that Jim pointed out, which we saw in the crater that he was using as his control point, and in several others. Next slide, please. Here is a dramatic view of the lunar horizon as we're approaching the near side, the Kachi Scarp area, some arcuate rills, and I think this is probably the best photo we have to really give you a true representation of the color of the moon. All you really need is black and white, and it really brings out the very smooth nature of the mare with these large features in it. Jim, would you care to?
How do I press it just please? This is the Sea of Tranquility, I believe, and we're approaching what was one of our main objectives in the flight, was to observe one of our landing sites. It's a landing site on the eastern side of the moon as we see it from Earth. It's called East 2. And our job was to look at the landing site to see whether the sun angles were correct as had been predicted for observing or for proper landing. Could we have the next slide, please? This is East 2 as we are approaching it. We had two initial points coming into the actual landing site area. We weren't too sure when we got to the moon whether we could find a small crater, which we are using as a pseudo-landing site, which was just short of East 2. And so we used, first of all, a rill at the bottom of the photograph, which actually it was quite more pronounced than this photograph indicates. This was called the initial point 1. And as our track continued on into the Sea of Tranquility, we came up to initial point 2, a triangular-shaped mountain. Over here we have the Pyrenees. This was timed from this point to this point and then on into our landing site. Next slide, please. This is actually a picture of our landing site. We are near the area of the crater Masculine, and this is it over here in the distance. This is called Masculine F. It's a half-buried crater. The Pyrenees are over here to the left, and in between, right down in here, is our what we called our pseudo-landing site, or B1. That was our primary objective for this particular flight. I'm happy to announce that our visual observation of this particular site, it appeared that from the first initial point right on through to our landing site area, the lighting conditions are sufficient and adequate for a lunar landing, which is one of our objectives of the flight.
Next slide, please. The next series is a sequence of sides as we move away from the moon after our trans-Earth insertion. This is the large crater Humboldt, interesting because of, again, one of these anomalous dark regions, and particularly so because of these cracks. Now, we saw a lot of cracks in the surface, but these are particularly interesting because they are the few that we saw that were actually white. And are very anomalous. This is the northern edge of the Southern Sea. Next, please. Here is a view of the moon. Bright crater you see right here is about 130 degrees east, 70 degrees south in lunar longitude. Here's another dark crater like Tsiolkovsky. Next. Here is Tsiolkovsky. Our track essentially came right along here, right along the side of the moon. And next slide, please. Here is a view of the northern portion of the moon with a new and large impact crater about the size of Tycho. These long rays girdle the moon for quite a distance and actually been observed on the near side. And this crater of this nature had been postulated in this position, rays coming from the near side in this direction. It's the first time it was ever photographed in this high a sun angle, which brought out these features so dramatically. We have photos that essentially sectioned the whole moon at about this altitude. We've just selected some here to bring out the more dramatic features. Next, please. Here's a view of the moon in color film. As we move farther away, Tsiolkovsky here, the new impact crater here, our track coming generally in this direction. Sea of Fertility and Crises shown, Smice Sea. Next, please. And here's a view that looked very good to us on the way back, the view of the good Earth. Next. Frank, do you care to comment on this one?
Back. I think this is the last picture. This is the picture of the entry that we experienced over the Western Pacific. And I don't believe any of us are convinced that it's either the command module or the service module. But I would like to take this opportunity here to describe the entry. It was the most unrealistic event of the entire flight for me. The whole spacecraft was bathed in a light that made you feel like you're inside of a neon tube. And we experienced, of course, the usual G-forces, and we sat there and watched the autopilot guide the spacecraft to a perfect pinpoint accurate landing point. Now, you should remember that the entry was made in complete darkness, and we all the chutes were put out in darkness, and we were really not sure when we were going to hit the water. But once we got the main chutes out, we all sort of relaxed and felt, well, this is the end of a long, hard trip, and it's going to be great, because the Apollo 7 crew had mentioned how soft they entered the water. And just about the time we were congratulating ourselves, we hit the water with a tremendous impact. And I had been telling Bill Anders, now, get the circuit breakers in for the chute release right away, because I want to get this chute off before we go over in stable two or nose down position. Well, Bill did his job very well, but about the time we hit with this big impact, I got doused with water that was forced its way in through some vent tubes. And I looked around to see why we were sinking. And by the time I got back to release the parachutes, we were in stable two. So we ended up upside down in the Atlantic. We uprighted ourselves in about 4.5 minutes. We were in continuous contact with the Navy, and they picked us up immediately at daybreak, and I guess that was about the end of our mission. I know that you all are most interested in asking questions, and so we've purposely hurried through this part of the flight to try to pick up the main points as we saw them, and I think it would now be appropriate perhaps to turn to Julian.
We'll take questions and answers, and please identify yourself.
Dave Shoemaker with CBS. Colonel Borman, you said just a moment ago that that's where it begins to get lonely. And throughout your flight, as you flew to the moon and were around it and on your way back, you made several calls that indicated you were indeed lonely out there. Was this a difficult flight psychologically?
Not for me, it wasn't. We'll have to ask Jim and Bill. It was psychologically, it was a far easier flight than Gemini 7. You adopt a philosophical approach after you burn TLI, and I really wasn't concerned about anything. When you're in Earth orbit, you have you always are aware that if something happens, you have to react immediately to get down. Once you burn TLI, you really lose interest in, or you don't lose interest, but you're really not concerned with reacting swiftly because it's going to take you 2 or 3 days to get home anyway.
But you didn't feel isolated.
No, there was no isolation. How could you feel isolated when you're trapped with two guys like this?
Frank, Devin, Bill, you mentioned the new impact craters. How new are those impacts? Since the last lunar orbiter, for instance?
I think we're talking about new geologically, if I may use that expression.
We don't know. A couple hundred thousand years, perhaps. Depends on what the lunar erosion characteristics are.
Has it not been identified previously in pictures?
The lunar orbiter did an excellent job of mapping the moon on the near side. But because of its highly elliptical orbit on the backside, which was, I think, roughly 1,100 miles, it only got rather distant views. And details of this have never been photographed before. So by new, yes, they were new in the fact that they're the first time they've been seen and photographed, but also new... relatively speaking, in lunar age.
Well, certainly maybe you've seen news. Frank, how tough is the lunar landing going to be in terms of lighting based on the experience you and Jim and Bill have had? Was the lighting angle and the sun angles worse or better than you thought? And if you had started down then from the orbital position you were in around the moon, how tough would the landing have been on the lamp?
I think that we should let Jim answer this. He did the lighting evaluation. I would like to add my own impression. We, of course, looked at lighting simulations here on Earth. I think the lighting is much more amenable. The actual lighting is much more amenable to landing the limb than we had suspected. But Jim is the man that did the lighting evaluation. I'll ask you for his...
Jules, we're pleasantly surprised at what we found in the vicinity of our pseudo-landing site, which we were doing as the evaluation. We felt, and as we reported, that the lighting conditions from the first initial point, the rill, which I showed you in the photograph, through the second initial point, the triangular mountain, up to and including a point called B2, which was going to be our prime look-see landing site if we had lifted off about an hour later. These areas are sufficient for good lighting for a lunar crew coming in for a landing. Much better than, of course, what you saw near the subsolar point in those photographs. And I think I'd much rather land there than I would in Earthshine. Bill, do you have any comments?
Yes, I think we've all seen in the orbiter pictures and in these pictures, too, that you do get this washout of detail, topography, at the zero-phase sun angle. That is, looking at the point where your head shadow would be. But I think that the human eye has a much greater dynamic range, a much greater ability to look into these bright areas and at the same time seeing the shadows. So I think the lighting situation will be
we could
much
see
better.
Detail in the shadows, which is not reflected
we
in the pictures.
We amazed us, too, that we could do this.
As you were coming in, you would have had depth perception.
That's right.
You had a runway apparition there, or feeling to it, if you needed it.
John Wilson.
John Wilson, New York Times. From what you saw of the moon, have you picked out one or two places you would most like to land and visit? Most interesting?
Go ahead. I think that perhaps I'm speaking for all three when I say that on the near side, we had a crescent moon. We were only seeing a portion of that side that is familiar to us. Certainly the landing site, which has been selected, that was in sunlight, in my way of thinking, is an excellent place to go. We have not had an opportunity to observe, of course, in Apollo 8, the other prime landing sites.
I came away with the idea that the moon may be more homogeneous than I had realized, that the material here looked just about like it did over there. Now, there were areas of dark, which I suppose are lava flows that are different from the highlands. But nevertheless, the lava here looked like the lava over there. I came away with the idea that you could get a spoon one place and find it just about the same as the sample somewhere else.
I think the one big difference is the difference between the Mare and the Terra.
That's right.
The Terra being an order of magnitude rougher.
Right.
In a topographical sense and also in a landing sense, probably.
Roy Neal, NBC News. To us here on the Earth, one of the real highlights of your mission was your reading from Genesis. Can you give us some background on that? Where the idea came from? How it was how you handled it?
Yes, Roy, we can. We were, of course, aware that we were going to have television on board the spacecraft. And I might add, and I think it's appropriate to add here, We did not originally have television on this flight, and quite frankly, the flight crew, we were rather disinterested in whether it came on or whether it didn't come on, but fortunately the decision wasn't left to us, and it was on, and we were very grateful that it was on. Having had television, we said we wanted to do something significant, because here we are around the moon on Christmas and so on, and we consulted with friends, we thought among ourselves. We first thought perhaps we would it would be more of the one world theme, where we would tell everyone on Earth that we're living on one Earth. But then, one of the suggestions was to read the first 10 verses of the Bible, and that seemed so appropriate and so simple that we adopted that.
And how did you follow through? Did you actually have a Bible with you?
We had three Bibles with us, one each.
Where did they come from, and did you each read from your own Bibles?
Oh, some of them were personal Bibles, and some of them were given to us, believe it or not, by the Gideons. No, they were all packed in Calif, which is non-flammable.
Bibles won't burn, you know that.
Rudy Abrams of the LA Times, there's been some suggestion that the three of you might wind up on Apollo 11, although I guess from what we hear that Colonel Borman's out of this now. Jim and Bill, after seeing it up close, do you want to land on it? Would you like to go back?
I definitely would. I think that the last 60 miles are going to be the most significant, and what we find once we step on the lunar surface will be tremendous.
Do you think it's, Sarah McClendon, El Paso Times, do you think it's more important to go back there than to go to somewhere else now? Mars, Venus?
We haven't been there yet, really.
Do you think that maybe you should concentrate now on seeing something else?
We have an active program which states a lunar landing, and I think we should see through it. Keep going.
Stick with the easy ones.
In the colored pictures, did you see any indication of plant life or water in those dark areas?
Turn to the man with the greatest imagination for that one. Bill, did you see any plant life or water?
Yeah, quite a few of our color photographs do show what would appear to be some greens and purples. Let me assure you that it was a black and white world, and no signs of grass or algae or anything. And
or flying objects, flying UFO.
Along the same lines, did you see anything that was not natural? In other words, did you see any remains of earlier spacecraft or any indications of where one might have landed or bounced?
Had we launched slightly later than we did, the lighting would have allowed us to at least look into the area where Surveyor 5 was located, which whose location is not exactly known. We hope we might see a glint from one of its solar arrays, but that was dark for our launch time.
Colonel Borman, Jack Robertson, Electronic News. To Congress today, you mentioned that in a few years you hope to have see an international community exploring the moon, much as Antarctica. Have you had any expression from the Russians? Are there any concrete plans, or is this just a nebulous hope?
This was a personal opinion of how we'll go, of how I think the exploration of the moon will develop.
What leads you to that?
What leads me to that? Well, I think that the initial halting steps that we're taking now with the Apollo program will lead us to a greater curiosity and more potentially rewarding discoveries. And I feel that this would be a logical step to.
Deb Clark, this week, two questions for Jim. What have you heard since you've come back about the haze that you saw at sunrise, and what have the geologists had to say about the whirl effect or swirl effect in the crater?
Let me answer the first part of your question, and I'll let Bill, who has been more closely working with the geologists, in the second part. In our control point tracking, we have on board what is known as an auto-optics system, and on our second pass around, I had the optics in this particular automatic positioning. The control point was just after we went into the light side from the darkness, and I was observing through the scanning telescope, which has some 60 degrees field of view, the darkened craters. Now, this is an area where there is also no earthshine, and as I was watching the horizon from where the stars were located, I saw some rays coming up, animating from the center, which appeared to me earlier somewhat similar to zodiacal light, if you're familiar with that term. And as I saw this come up, it became brighter, and suddenly I could see the sun reflecting off the peaks, and about this time it was obvious to me what was going to happen, and I moved my eye back because sunrise comes quite abruptly around the lunar surface, and the sun did come up. After talking to the astronomers about it, it appears that what I was looking at was, in effect, somewhat similar to zodiacal light, with perhaps just prior to sunrise, seeing the
solar corona,
from the sun. No, I thought that perhaps it was due to light scattering on the optics, but they feel that the same phenomenon exists around the moon as it does around the Earth.
We did follow the stars right into the lunar horizon on the dark side, and none were observed to twinkle. They were either there or they weren't. With respect to the swirls that were seen in at least several craters, Frank mentioned the G's on entry. There were a few gee whizzes from the geologist, and that's about as far as they've gone.
Vera Glasser of North American Newspaper Alliance. Colonel Borman, what, in your view, is the reason the Soviet Union has been able to put a woman up into space while the United States has not? And how long do you think it's going to be before the United States gives women the professional and technical opportunities to encourage them to participate in space flight?
Here's the answer. I don't know whether that's a question or a speech, but... But I've never been one that that felt that it was required that the woman go into space as an astronaut. Women go into space as an astronaut. Astronauts. We've had great support from ladies, the engineers, the lady that worked on our reentry entry guidance system did a fantastic job. I suppose if the women would like to undertake this sort of work. They can always apply to NASA. I don't know really why you'd want to do it. It's kind of long hours and relatively low pay. But I don't look for the day when we'll have American women astronauts.
Hmm? Does NASA discourage this?
I don't think they discourage it, but there really haven't been any women that really meet the total qualifications. There's some pretty ones. But...
Colonel Borman. Just exactly what does this motion of yours mean, both in terms of your availability for the Apollo 11 crew and in terms of later flight while you might hold this position? Are you still a candidate for future?
No, I'll be working for Deke now in his office as his deputy.
I thought I lost the boss, but I see I've got him again.
Jim Maloney, the Houston Post. I'd like to ask Colonel Borman why he chose to not attempt another flight, and then to ask Jim and Bill if they expect to make a lunar landing mission.
Okay, well, I'll start off. Jim, before I flew this flight, I talked to the people in NASA and told them that this would, in all likelihood, be the last flight that I'd like to attempt. And the reason, I suppose, are many, but quite frankly, I, as you know, went down to investigated the 204 fire, and I participated in helping to work on the spacecraft, and I had a very strong desire to fly the Apollo spacecraft from a personal standpoint, because I'd been involved so deeply in the changes and the results of the investigation. But I've never felt that this was a personal desire should influence the final outcome of the program. And I'd like to correct one thing. After our initial interviews, somebody made the point that we had campaigned for 2 years for this flyby or this flight. That's completely untrue. We were told about it in August, completely to our surprise. So I felt that having had this successful flight and having worked my way through it, that I would step aside. Jim, he wanted to talk about to Jim and Bill about the...
In my own personal view about space flight, I'm rather addicted to it. I feel it's a great opportunity to further explore, and I'm available.
My professional curiosity makes me want to get a little closer look at the lunar surface and also to spend a little more time in Earth orbit.
Colonel Borman, the Russians claim that if you had failed in your retro rocket to get yourself out of the moon's orbit, they would have sent up a rescue ship to help you in line with the treaty that they signed for the rescue and return of astronauts. Do you feel they really would have? And if they did, do you think it would have been effective?
Well, I didn't know they had said that, but I appreciate their interest, and we certainly would have appreciated any effort they could have made. But in all likelihood, as we've been saying time and again, I don't think that the rescue capability exists either within this country or within Russia. The problems are insurmountable at this time.
Daily News. Colonel Borman, this is an incredibly troubled plea for free flight, or at least it seems so from the ground. Was there any point in which you had fears for the mission? And also, was there any point in which you had fears for the mission? And also, did the windows give you any special trouble? Window clouding.
I had no fears for the mission. I'd like to say at this time that one of the great comforts was flying with Jim and Bill. We worked together for a long time. I had perfect confidence in Jim's ability to navigate back in case we had lost communications, and I don't think there's any man in the entire country that knows all the systems of the Apollo spacecraft better than Bill Anders. We were fortunate in the fact that we did not have to use the many months of intensive training that we had for malfunctions. So as far as I was concerned, it was a perfect trouble-free mission.
Fred Barr, Chicago Tribune. Colonel Borman, I wonder if you could tell us what Chief Justice Warren said to you after your...
I'm sorry, sir, I can't hear you.
Could you tell us what Chief Justice Warren said to you after your speech at the...
He was very pleasant.
Bill Evan from Air Force Magazine. Colonel Borman, a lot of us were worried about your indisposition during the early part of the flight. Can you tell us what it was like within reason and how you coped with it medically?
Yes, well, I think Jim ought to describe first perhaps the sensation we all had when we unstrapped first, to begin with.
As I said in my little talk before, I was the first one out of my seat during Earth parking orbit. And I had quickly gone to work doing the various odds and ends and things that I had to do, and I was sort of the chief cook and bottle washer, getting everything for everybody else. And I moved around quite rapidly, and I found out that's a mistake, because in moving around rapidly in zero G, before you become used to it, it can be very similar to that queasy feeling you get if you're not used to being aboard ship, seasickness to be exactly correct. And so I just slowed down and took it easy, and about a couple hours it goes away. I think that we all felt that once we got out of the seats, and it takes a little while for it to go away.
I had this initial indication, but it went away, and then as I mentioned before, we had difficulties getting away from the S-4B. We stayed with it longer than we want to, so when I went into the sleep station for my sleep cycle, I was 2 hours behind. And I don't know how many of you have gone to sleep saying, well, if I don't get to sleep right now, I'm going to be tired when I wake up. It makes it very difficult to sleep. And so I did the thing that I testified to all of you that I'd never do before. I took a sleeping pill. And when I woke up, I felt terrible. And I suffered as long as I could, and I finally threw up twice, and I immediately felt better. We're not certain whether it was a 24-hour virus or a reaction to sleeping pill. But by the time the people on the ground had prescribed something, I was all better, and I didn't take any of the medication that was prescribed. I tried a sleeping pill later on and had the same type of reactions.
Scott Weber, the Journal News, Nyack, New York. Why couldn't the SV-4 have been used into the re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere?
SPS.
To slow
Bill,
you down.
Why don't you answer that one?
You must mean the SPS,
yeah.
The onboard engine. The velocity increases terrifically as you're approaching entry. And I think any effort to slow yourself down, you'd just get behind the timeline and end up having that thing hung onto you as you hit the atmospheric interface. So I think the best thing to do is come in without it, except the higher velocities.
Albert Sales at Baltimore Sun. Colonel Borman, could you describe a little more of this impact you mentioned at the outset and how it was a little harder than you expected, and also how the water came through the vents?
Well, this is really, we should have expected this, because every one of our Gemini landings was a different experience. Gemini on 7 hit very smoothly. On 12,
very hard.
He got a very hard block. The water came in through the cabin pressure relief valves, even though they were locked. And we probably got, what would you say, about 2 quarts of water? About a half a gallon of water in that spacecraft.
Carvalho, for VOA of Brazil. Yesterday, I believe, the American press published a story about NASA plans for the next 10 years. And they're talking about landings, an average of 3 landings on the moon every year. You think during the next decade, the LAM and the Apollo will be the major vehicles for that kind of exploration on the moon, or going to be changed?
Well, I think certainly right now, as you see what happened in Apollo 8, we're developing. Apollo 8 actually was an evaluation of the first step of a transportation system. The Apollo program essentially is a transportation to the moon. It's also a basic transportation system to other places in the universe. I feel that if we are to explore the moon in the near future, the command module and the lunar module will be the basic vehicles for it.
Bill Perkinson, Baltimore Evening Sun. 2 questions on the lighter side. I'll skip Colonel Borman. Captain Lovell, you have 2 daughters, Barbara 14 and Susan 10, and Colonel Anders, you have 1 daughter, Gail 8. Do you think that any of the 3 will be able to go to the moon in their lifetime if they want to?
Difficult question to answer. My daughter's...
Yes or no? Quit hedging. Come on. Yes or no?
I don't think they care to after my...
Let me say that historically we've always been surprised by the rapid advance of technology. And I think it'll, by the time they're mature enough to do the job, that probably women will have already done it.
All hail the Tom.
If I could ask Colonel Borman if, on the basis of the debriefing and the experience, that if there were any unexpected developments in the area of space medicine that is a result of your debate.
No, I don't believe there are any unexpected developments at all. Certainly this flight was, Jim and I can both testify that when we landed from this flight, we were in far better shape than we were from the, than we got out of the Gemini 7 after 14 days. I think we were in excellent shape, and I think the pre-flight and post-flight physical examination will verify it.
Did you have any trouble in shaving? Did you have any trouble in shaving?
No, ma'am. I got kidded so much about having a light beard after Gemini 7 that I just shaved what I had off in the helicopter. So.
He shaved them both off.
Colonel Borman, David Bowes with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. A good many Americans, thoughtful Americans, are thrilled by this mission and fully appreciate the importance of exploration, but who still harbor serious doubts about heavy funding for programs like this when so many unfortunate situations remain on Earth. Do you understand the point that they make, and what is your reply to them?
Well, I think we all understand. I think that... I alluded to this morning when I was fortunate enough to talk to the joint session. There's no question in anyone's mind that we have many serious problems here on the Earth and in this country. I'm not sure you'll solve them all by neglecting the quest for knowledge that we're undertaking. And certainly within NASA, and my own station in NASA, I'm not the one that makes the decisions as to how many funds or how much monies will be spent where. All I'm saying is that the next administration, I hope that the next administration will carefully consider not only the technical and the scientific value of this program, but also the value, the almost nebulous value that it has as to the spirit of this country.
Carrying the question a step further that was just asked about the your children, I wonder if each one of you could tell us in as concrete terms as possible, either with quotes or whatever, what were a couple of the reactions, perhaps a couple of the questions that your children asked you following this flight?
Well, my kids have been associated with space flight here in their community for quite a bit, and I think they're more interested in the local firemen and fire chiefs than they are in astronauts.
When my oldest son called me a traveling man instead of an astronaut, I knew that I hadn't made it at home. But the questions were the same as the general public asked. They want to know what we saw. And my little son, Jeffrey, who's three, always asked about the rocket and airplanes and spacecraft. Those were the first three words that he learned.
My boys reacted with magnificent indifference.
WFAN-TV. Colonel Borman, first of all, it's been said that Gus Grissom had severe doubts about the quality of his craft. Was that true? And if you had had any doubts about your craft, would you have gone up in it? And secondly, when, if ever, do you think a reporter might be allowed to go on these flights?
I never talked to Gus about his idea of the quality of Apollo. I'm sure that he wouldn't have been in spacecraft 12 if he didn't think it was a safe spacecraft.
That went around, though.
Pardon me?
That is a rumor that went around the Cape. Was there any truth to
that? That probably is a rumor. I don't know whether it's founded or not. But I think it's important, and I had this feeling that when we testified after the fire investigation, that although we were completely candid and completely honest as to what we found and to what we thought, that the people never really believed us. And that was one of the things that gave me such a strong personal desire to prove that what we said had been the truth. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that we won't have additional tragedies in this program. But what I would like to submit and what we tried to make the point is that this program is worth the price we have to pay. I don't know when the reporters will go, but I hope they all wear miniskirts when they do.
Were there any significant, or did they look for any significant changes brought about by radiation, the combination of radiation and weightlessness or anything of that sort?
Bill Andrews is our expert in that field, sir.
No, we received a negligible radiation dose.
Both weightlessness. There wasn't any combined effect of weightlessness and radiation.
No, our radiation dose was barely measurable, I assure you.
Gentlemen,
what do you feel now when you look up at the moon? What do you think about when you look up at the moon from the Earth?
That again is a pro. I think we all ought to answer that one. Bill, why don't you start off?
I almost find it hard to believe that I really went. I must say that it seems a little closer now than it had in the past, and I guess I'll never forget the view of the backside that we had for the first time.
Well, the first impression that Bill had, of course, I think is true of all three of us. It's hard to realize when you look at the moon that we actually made the journey. And after seeing the rather cold and lifeless sort of black and white world that we did see up there, I'm kind of curious how all the songwriters can refer to in such romantic terms.
I have the same feeling of really wondering, looking and saying, wondering if we're really there. It does look a lot closer, and of course I'm very grateful for the way things turned out. It was just you have a feeling of immense satisfaction.
I wonder if we could the astronauts could describe in more detail the geography of the landing site as they saw it, the Sea of Tranquility. Were there any obstacles there to landing at all?
The landing site is in the Sea of Tranquility. It's just north of the Pyrenees Mountains, just south of a crater called Masculine F, a half-buried crater. The site itself has been well documented by Orbiter because it was down at the altitudes we are at. Our photographic equipment did not produce in detail what we already had for vision or for instruction before we went on the flight. Our job was merely qualitative, to see whether eyeball that we could in fact land in that area from the vision point of view. I looked for but did not find any boulders, and I was looking for boulders primarily to see if I could see something about the size of the limb, and to see if we could track the limb, which would be important in our guidance system when the limb comes back up in rendezvous. I feel that we can do that.
Walter Cronkite, CBS. That communications problem that you had because of the high noise level on launch and the heavy impact on landing, do either of these problems portend any difficulties in future Apollo flight?
No, sir. I don't believe so. The noise level was high, but I don't think that we all feel that we could hear emergency communications, and we have the abort lights that come on. The impact, I think, each one is going to be its own experience. You know, some of them will be soft and some of them will be hard.
Second question, just very quickly, if I may. I'm a little worried about your curiosity quotient. How is it possible to get that close to the moon and not yaw around for a look at it?
Well, there, but Mr. Cronkite was wondering about Jim's statement that we burned into lunar orbit much the way a pilot goes into an airport in a blinding snowstorm on faith in the GCA. And in all reality, we looked at many optical methods to determine if we could determine whether we could really be sure on board that we were going to miss the moon. You know, there's always consideration you might be 60 miles too low, which is not a comforting one. But
61
but we looked into this MISFIN very carefully, and I knew that the people on the ground were very happy with it when we made our last mid-course correction to correct our altitude from 69.4 to 60.5. So they were actually lowering us, and there was really nothing you could do at this time except believe what we had already studied, and that was true.
Comment there. Let me add one other comment. Well, it wasn't that we didn't want to look, and I think if we had looked, we could have seen things that were of interest, but our attitudes were of the spacecraft. The pointing of the spacecraft was tightly controlled for thermal and communications reasons.
And we were also coming to the dark side of the moon itself. The crescent was becoming very thin and almost non-existent.
Vic McNally, Boston Globe. One of the things that you probably studied in advance of this flight was the first description of the moon through a telescope made by Galileo. Is there anything that you saw on this flight that was reminiscent of Galileo's first description of the moon?
You can go if you want.
But here is a scientist.
But your basic premise wasn't correct.
Should you elaborate that? What do you mean by his basic premise?
I didn't study Galileo's first description. That may not be very romantic, but we had some very good orbiter pictures to study.
We've been listening to the version for the first time of the flight
talking to you about
by the crew of Apollo 8.
Anthony, Frank, do you have any idea what will be happening in Alan Shepard, who has been holding down that position till now?
No. So let me answer the second one first so I don't get in trouble before I start my new job.
Okay.
Al Shepard has not been the deputy director. He's the chief of the astronaut office, and he'll continue in that position. The first question, I don't believe we saw anything, learned anything significant, except that we performed a flight test. I don't believe that we found anything that would be of concern to future flights. We flight tested the ground system, we flight tested the airborne system. The command module and service module have effectively performed their design task, their design mission, with the exception of docking. We've got magnificent machinery. We have superb ground support. And I think that's what we found.
Can I expound on that just a little bit? One thing that we checked on the way home, which was very comforting to the crews, is our onboard capability of returning to Earth, which is done by the optical computer system, which came out very close to what the ground predicted. And the second thing, which had nothing to do with the hardware system, but which looks to me, to us rather, to be significant, is the fact that our sleep-rest cycles will probably have to be more like they were in the later Gemini flights, where all three of us are going to be bedded down for the translunar journey, so that we have full capacity when we get into lunar orbit.
John Chancellor from NBC. We know you don't make the final decisions, but personally, if everything works as well, when do you think we'll land a man on the moon?
This summer.
Can you be more precise?
Apollo 11.
Over here. Noel Grove with the Newspaper Enterprise. You mentioned that once you found that you, when you slowed down in your activities under zero G, that gave you less trouble. Was there anything throughout the rest of the flight that was unpleasant? That might be unpleasant over extended flights about zero G.
After we became accustomed to zero gravity, that was all there was to that. Of course, three men in a small container isn't exactly the most pleasant conditionings for a long time, but there was nothing that was really unpleasant.
Nope. I think we became accustomed to the zero gravity effect pretty rapidly, and I think it's quite pleasant.
He's talking about perhaps the Apollo applications, the long-range flights. We found several things that we think need to be improved. I think that we need to concern ourselves with proper engineering for better bodily waste disposal systems. We have to provide showers on board. We have to have some sort of entertainment, television or canned tapes. We have to look into better food. We have to realize that when you put a man on orbit for 60 days or perhaps even longer, you have to pay more attention than we have had to in the past to his basic creature comforts. Yeah, is that what you were
saying? Bill there, our prime candidate for the first and second manned lunar landing flights, presumably. What things did you two see on Apollo 8? What questions were raised on Apollo 8 that you want to see answered when you two land?
Do you mean how would we improve what we did on Apollo 8 for future Apollo flights?
What questions were raised by what you two saw in lunar orbit that you want to answer when you land?
Well, for myself, I think I'd like to really explore some of the homogeneous mixture which Frank mentioned of the lunar surface. I'd like to see what's underneath it, Bill.
I think the same interest that existed before the flight exists with me now, that I'm interested in what the lunar surface is made of trying to find a clue or key to the history of the development of the moon, which I think will be useful knowledge in unraveling some of these secrets back here on Earth.
And how many times is it going to be useful to go there, to land there, after the second or third manned lunar landings? Is it a worthwhile place to go back to or to build a laboratory on?
Yes, I think so. I think that the more we go, the more interesting things we'll find that we didn't even expect to find prior to the first landing.
Warren, Buffalo News, when do you think a man will be landed on a planet, and what planet first?
I think that's the question we have to turn to the big thinker in the group.
Yeah.
That's...
Julian? I don't have any idea. We'd like to, of course, see some basic studies on planetary... equipment, planetary spacecraft, but when we can go there, I don't have any idea.
Certainly we have an awful lot of work to do in Earth orbit and lunar exploration, but I imagine it'll be sooner than we'd have guessed right now.
Back over here.
Colonel John Steamer, National Geographic. Colonel Anders, did you detect the presence or the influence of anything like NASCON? If so, could you equate them to any visible photography on the moon?
Our ground tracking people, I understand, were able, by analyzing our flight paths, detect slight anomalies in our trajectory in lunar orbit. Certainly we wouldn't have the physiological capability to detect this on board. I knew beforehand that there has been, that some of the features on the moon, the large mare, have been associated with NASCONs, and I saw those mares, so I went with some preconceived notion. Sir?
No way you could relate to?
No. No way other than the way that has been proposed.
One other thing, would you care to stop more emphatically for either the impact or the volcanic theory of the moon based on what you see?
Well, there are an awful lot of holes on the moon. I think there's enough holes for both theories.
You can tell he's a scientist right now, okay?
I think he's a weatherman. David, the charge of Christianity today, Colonel Borman, beyond the Bible reading and prayer, what was the religious significance of the flight?
Well, the religious significance of the flight, at least personally, to me, was the opportunity to view firsthand this mass of matter that perhaps unfold some of the secrets as to how everything started. And I don't think that any of us could undertake. I'm not aware of any man that could undertake this kind of journey without some belief or some. At least I couldn't. And so it was a fulfillment for me of a very basic belief. Again, I think this is a personal question.
Ken Weaver.
What effect would this have on the mission?
Wouldn't have your slideshow. It's been like a submarine. It's pretty much like a submarine anyway, but...
If you, in your executive position now, Colonel Borman, could choose, realizing how important the moon has been to a target for the entire space program, what target would you choose next?
After the lunar? Julian just reminded me a minute ago that instead of saying that we're going to land on the moon on Apollo 11, in my new job, I should say, hopefully, we're going to land on the moon on Apollo 11. So I don't know whether I dare answer this one or not, except to say that I would conceive of a program where we not only colonize, when I say colonize, we establish an exploration base on the moon, but then we turn to a long-duration permanent Earth orbital station, which we not only conduct Earth resources and scientific type investigations, but we use certain sections of this vehicle to engineer and develop systems that will enable us to go to the planets and out of the solar system.
Back over.
Go ahead.
Could you recreate the dialogue that immediately preceded and immediately followed sighting the Earth on the first orbit of the Earth?
I don't.
It's being replaced with a tailor. That was quite an awe-inspiring sight, of course, to come around the far side of the moon, being as rocky or as holy, I guess, as you could see, and then suddenly see the Earth rise. I might add that the only color that we could see in the universe from our position out there is the Earth. And I don't think words can describe what you can see.
I think one of the first comments was, please pass me the camera.
Yeah, the events at the time are not nearly as dramatic as one might think. Probably the most dramatic period of the flight was the period during the trans-Earth burn. But once that burn was over, we knew we were on our way home, and when we saw the Earth, it was anticlimactic, really, then.
Lasso Doja, VOA. On your way out, you reported that the moon seems to have a blue sky. Have you ever found any explanation for this?
Yes, that report concerned itself with our optic sightings, the first one of flat navigation on the way out to the moon, translunar. I looked at the moon through the sextant, and the moon, of course, was crescent. The sun was very close, and one of the phenomena in the optics is the fact that the sun scatters light all through the optics, and the sky, the space surrounding the moon, had a light bluish tint, much like the blue sky that we see here on Earth. Of course, there isn't an atmosphere there, but it's the light scattering due to the sun because of the crescent shape of the moon that causes this.
Ron Wiley, Intercollegiate Press. If we had been so fortunate to get you out of lunar orbit, or if you would have skipped back out on re-entry, did the program call for self-destruction of the crew?
That's never been even considered.
When, I believe you said you looked through the optics back at the Earth, through the navigation optics system, how fine a detail could you see on the Earth when you looked back?
Of course, with the sextant, we use landmarks. We have the capability of using landmarks such as points of land, isthmuses, and things like this to mark on. Actually, I was interested in the horizon. You can only see the detail that is not cloud-covered, of course. The horizon, which has always been one of controversy, when you first look at it just after leaving the Earth, is quite hazy, as we found out in Gemini. And one of our problems in navigation close to the Earth is this wide horizon atmospheric band that we have to look at closely.
How big were your landmarks, and how far away were you when you were looking at it?
Well, I think that the pictures show that we could see Florida, we could see the peninsula of the Cape quite well, we could see the islands and the West Indies. You could see quite a bit of detail.
In reference to the landing, you're
When you landed, there was more accuracy in landing than previous missions. Did that point to possibly a turf landing eventually?
You were asking whether we have the capability for land landing?
Would that point the accuracy would maybe bring it into a turf landing eventually?
The accuracy of this mission was comparable to the mission of Apollo 7. The land landing capability is not dependent upon the accuracy of the spacecraft guidance as much as it is upon the ability of the spacecraft structure to withstand the impact. And we think we have this capability within the Apollo as it exists now. It's been tested. We feel confident that we could survive a land landing, but it would be a more hazardous experience than landing in the water. So with the present hardware, we will continue to land in the water.
Foreseeable future, you'll still be continuing in the water?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Two questions. One, just a clarification, Colonel Borman. Did you test that sleeping still before the flight, along with the other guys? Did you get the reaction?
Yes, we tested the sleeping pills before the flight, and we all had an unpleasant reaction from them that we associated with an attack of the virus that was going around the Cape. I'm not prepared to say now whether what I had was reaction to sleeping pill or the virus.
Captain Hummel, a major portion of this mission was to demonstrate navigational techniques that were used during the landing mission, particularly the rendezvous, and to clear up uncertainty before that. How successfully did you clear up any uncertainty? Did you find anything in navigating that makes it more difficult or less difficult on the landing mission?
As far as the navigation guidance system on board the Apollo, I was very pleasantly surprised with the operation of that system. It performed to such a degree that I never did expect it to be that accurate. The cislunar work was very accurate as compared to the ground, and the tracking capability in lunar orbit was much better than I expected.
One more question, right here.
Was there any moment during the mission in which you were a little bit scared or frightened?
Sure, I was scared or frightened during a lot of the phases of the mission, but I think that fear is a normal human reaction and one that's not detrimental to the flight as long as you keep it under control. Let's say that I was anxious during the more dynamic phases, but I think that this was well controlled. And all of us performed it, our job is required.
We were all anxious, we were all happy to see the TEI burn completed, although there was never any doubt in my mind that it would be completed.
But that is the apprehensive part of the mission, no doubt. This is it.
Thank you very much.